You are listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry, and I am Dr. Scott Terry. I am a licensed therapist. I run the Arden Counseling Center and about four other groups throughout a wide region here. Rob Hubler, my co-host, is with us today. Rob, tell us about yourself and the show today.
I am a retired Presbyterian minister, and I lived here in Fairfield in the late 60s and early 70s before MUM came here. And I have been in the military. I've served in the military for 7 years.
On submarines.
Came back to pardon me?
On a submarine, no less.
On a submarine, not in the Marines, but submarines, right. And I came back to Fairfield about 6 years ago to run a nonprofit, and for about 6 months, and haven't left yet.
Okay.
All right.
And tell us what we're doing today. We got two special guests today.
Yes, we do. We have Andrew Perry and Doug Hamilton, and they'll introduce themselves. And when we get there for a second, but let's just talk about a little bit of news about what's going on in Fairfield.
Sounds great.
All right. This last week we had a meeting out on the MUM campus. The Fairfield Mental Health Alliance. And it was a process meeting that was run by Ken Daly. It was, I think, a very good meeting. It took a whole lot of diverse opinions of people, put them all down on paper, got people on track, running in the right direction, and came up with some interesting results. So you two were there. Both of you were there, weren't you? Yeah. What did you think of it?
Andrew? So Andrew, introduce yourself.
Yeah, introduce yourself, Andrew.
Introduce yourself and tell us what you thought of the meeting.
Yeah, this is Andrew Perry. I grew up here in Fairfield and attended MSAE. I am currently working with a nonprofit here in town, the Bunnell Project. We have a couple different properties. We provide space and support for community members to work on things they're passionate about. And I also have a pretty strong hobby interest in learning and psychology and human development. All those are...
Where'd you go to college?
Jumped around a little bit. My dad taught at Southeastern Community College, so I went there for a while.
I taught there for a while.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, great. I also attended MUM for a little bit, and that's it, yeah.
All right. Doug, tell us about yourself.
Let's see. I'm born and raised here in Iowa. And actually, I'm one of the first people to have started Transcendental Meditation when it was taught here in Iowa. So I kind of go back to those days. And I've lived in Fairfield since, I think, 86. I've been in business here and in a variety of different things over the years, and now I'm retired and I raise livestock and train horses, and I'm busy all day long doing things in retirement. I went to the meeting the other night. Ken Daly ran. It was really a great, very well facilitated meeting. We're to the point in this whole process of the Fairfield Mental Health Alliance of really looking at the cultural issues in the community that relate to mental health. And so Ken had a way of facilitating getting those issues on the table in front of people. And through a series of questions, there were about, 30 people in the room?
Yeah.
And then everybody was given a chance. He went around the room, and then that was recorded. It was written down by scribes and put in front of people.
What do you mean by cultural issues? Explain what you mean here.
The underlying things in our community, you know, the community here that have to do that with quality of mental health.
But this is not just about this community. There's cultural issues wherever we go. So if you happen to be listening to this in Chicago or Amsterdam, I like Amsterdam for the moment, what would be the similarities of thinking about cultural communities in that kind of a way, in a larger context? Andrew, what do you think?
Culture is often described, I think, as an analogy of an iceberg, where a lot of what you see is just the tip of it, and then most of it is the invisible underneath. And so you can have the artifacts of culture in the form of like behaviors, dress, and kind of policies, and that kind of reveals the underlying styles of thinking or assumptions or beliefs that people hold. So that gives you an idea of culture, I guess.
And so when we're looking at addressing cultural issues in this community, here, mm-hmm. it's really the same kind of concepts that anybody in any community could be looking at. Like, what is the limitations or possibilities from your cultural universe?
Yeah, absolutely. Carl Jung, famous psychologist, psychiatrist, wrote extensively on the human psyche, and he talks about the human shadow. And he describes the shadow essentially as the unconscious aspect of ourselves. And so I think that as each individual has an unconscious that's operating, also do communities and organizations. And a large part of that is, I think, cultural.
So are you saying we're culturally bound, or there's a shadow side to this community, or
there's a shadow side of every community. And if we were to, you know, continue with the Carl Jung idea.
Does that mean a negative aspect too?
It's unconscious, and so it's operating. His big thing was to make what's unconscious conscious. Mm-hmm. And so if it's showing up in you in a way that's you're not aware, you're not in control, then it's going to be, you could be experiencing symptoms as a result of that, that you're not sure how to troubleshoot. So the idea of a shadow isn't always negative, it's just an unconscious aspect. Mm. And so as you start to shed or bring it into the light, then your own creativity and intelligence can start acting upon it. So I think it's really significant for communities to have dialogue and to bring things that are unconscious or in shadow out into the light, so that our collective creativity and intelligence and insight can start nourishing these things if they are creating issues.
So our very own Ken Daly, who was just on the radio with us the other week and will be on again, the way that he was exploring that was how? How did you guys find what he was doing?
The facilitation process that he did.
Well, not just the facilitation, but what we're trying to actually get at. What does that actually mean? The cultural context of...
Well, I think Ken's main... when we first talked about this, I got the impression from him, and I'm being facetious now, but the impression from him that, you know, he had a process to sit down and figure out what the process was. And I was a little... I was a little confused, but when we got into the meeting, the process really was good, and what the end result was what I really was excited about, because we not only got everybody to express their own feelings about the culture and about what was bothering them in the culture and what was bothering other people in the culture, but we also moved on to what do we do about it? What are things that we ought to emphasize and to prioritize and to move on first? And everybody got to vote on, you know, they had all these things up on the board that had been written there, and everybody went around and voted three times. Those people from Chicago voted 8 times, but the rest of us voted just 3 times.
There we go.
So I thought it was a really interesting process. Obviously, the real substance is going to be what's going to be done with that, and he's going to be presenting that tonight, as a matter of fact, the full body of Mental Health Alliance.
And it really impacts, a community's issues really do impact the individual and the mental health of that individual. So if that community has some negative aspects or a shadow side that they're unaware of, such as in the meditating community, sometimes there's issues, even though the meditation could be a wonderful thing, sometimes some of the cultural aspects around that meditation might be difficult for some people.
For example, if you have an environment or a culture that encourages people to be ideal, and that's the expectation, then it can create an effect where people don't feel like they can show up or be honest about what's happening in their life if it's less than ideal, just as one example.
But it's also a positive thing. So it's kind of...
Sure, it encourages people to be kind of... seek their fullest expression as an individual.
Right.
But potentially, like, it could potentially create a shaming environment.
So it's back to that stigma issue. So
correct.
When you have something like an ideal routine, which I talk to everybody about, every client, you know, exercise, meditate, diet, sleep, and an optimal time, really forget about any cosmic influences, given the circadian rhythm, is around 10 o'clock. Now, in science, it could be anywhere from 8 to midnight, depending on how you're looking at daylight savings and your body clock, etc. But really, if you're going to bed too late, it really does influence you. And it really does create negative ramifications if you're not sleeping 7.5 to 9 hours of sleep. The problem is that though I could say those kind of things and say this is a good thing, you could start feeling bad if you're not able to obtain that all the time.
Correct.
Or if you start talking exercise, everybody should exercise. There isn't anybody who wouldn't agree exercise is a good thing. Except sometimes it could be a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
How would you say this?
I think you hit it on the head. If you're giving me what I would say is a recommendation that maybe has good scientific backing or whatever it is, then it's up to me to kind of choose to see how that integrates comfortably in my life. I think what we have is both, one, like you're saying, a pressure for me to adopt those, like in this instance, like the bedtime. Depending on the language they're using, presenting it to me, then I could experience, depending on my vulnerability or kind of openness and how much I recognize you as an authority, I could experience that as a lot of pressure, actually.
Exactly. So it could turn from a positive recommendation, but if it's...
to a source of psychological stress.
Oh my God, I can't, you know, where people go all or nothing thinking. Oh, you know, I've already screwed up. It's already late. And now I've really messed up.
So I think in addition to the personal pressure that you can place on yourself to kind of stand up to these the ideal routine or whatever it is, there's also, I think, an aspect of the community that develops this as just a way to judge people as well. And exactly. So we can kind of look to our neighbor and be, hey, they didn't go to bed by 10, or kind of speak about them in different ways, or even to them directly, and provide this additional kind of social pressure.
Absolutely. Rob?
I was just going to say that there's several people after the meeting, you want me to say that this is Mental Health Matters and you are listening to KRUU FM 100.1, Solar Power Radio, coming from Fairfield, Iowa.
Absolutely. And again, our email is mentalhealthmatters@kruufm.com.
Correct.
Please email us upcoming shows, other ideas. We'd love to do a call in or at least have your emails and say, here's a topic today that a listener sent in. Right. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
No, I was just saying that several people after this meeting with Ken Daly expressed a great relief in being able to have said what they wanted to say publicly. That was just a, you know, a real benefit of the meeting, to be able to get out some of the things that they consider to be, you know, culturally oppressive or whatever.
Which brings us back to Andrew's point about not shaming anybody.
Right.
That having a voice... just having a voice and being able to say what you need really brings that mental health issue back in. Because part of the problem, for instance, in, let's say, relationships, is that you start feeling shut down by your partner. And you start giving your power away to your partner, as opposed to getting what I want to create for myself so I can develop to who I need to be and so I can have an equal partnership. Your partner isn't doing anything to you that you're not creating. We create ourselves to be victims. And we're going to talk about paradigms for a second.
One thing to add to that, I think, is that I read someplace that it's a fundamental human need to be seen accurately in the mind of someone else. Mm. And so I think that even being able to speak out for the first time, regardless of why, relieve that pressure inside and to feel at least someone can affirm or recognize this kind of reality that you've been experiencing in isolation for so long.
Yeah, and I think the other side of that is that somebody was listening. I mean, it's one thing to be able to express your feelings in a soundproof room and you're the only one there,
or else
to express them and someone hears you.
And I would say that's how change actually takes place, too, is doing these novel things that have never been happening before. So new conversations are occurring. Mm. In terms of changing culture, this is how some culture can be changed, is developing or changing existing relationships or developing new relationships and changing the narrative. So culture as a narrative and as a set of relationships. So anytime you're changing relationships or you're changing the story of what we have, the story about what's going on in our community, the story between maybe authority and the people they, you know, have supposed authority over. But anyways, just anytime we change the story, we're changing culture.
But I part of that changing the story is remembering that you've got the voice. Nobody takes that voice away from you. And to that end, we had talked about some issues, how fascinating it would be to think about having other networks to create that. So sometimes that means going to a therapist or somebody who could not only hear your voice, but sit there and say, hey, let's look at doing something with this, empowering. But in other ways, peer-to-peer or other kinds of networks of finding your voice, utilizing that voice, stop being quiet.
Yeah, you say no one takes it away from you, but I think the experience of many people is they do feel like they don't have a way to speak out. And absolutely. So that's the nature of the being disempowered, is that you've come into pressures and circumstances that either taught you through a history of punishment and discouragement, in terms of there's negative consequences when you use your voice. And so one can develop a habit of not thinking that they can actually be honest in a situation or speak out about their experience.
Exactly. And I think it's those habits, those negative habits. Again, analogy to going to bed at a bad time and you get used to it, or to not exercising, or to whatever. But it's also to not have your voice.
Mm-hmm. I think there's an important relationship between community and the individual. You say that you always have your voice, and yes, I encourage that reality, but you also might exist in an environment that is discouraging that. And so when
so
I look at
how do you fight that?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, dialogue for me is just like making, if the circumstances around you, if the community that you're in isn't aware of the experiences that they might be causing through their behavior, or their, if there's a pattern of experience on the other side of a kind of a message sent in terms of behaviors and communications, then that can be a reporting back or a feedback loop of like, hey, you know, when you present it like that, I have this experience of judgment or shame or coercion or whatever, and maybe, you know, us three experience that as well. So Scott, did you know that when you talk like that, you know, it has this sort of coercive effect, which is an uncomfortable feeling,
and you might not be aware of it.
And you might not be aware. Yeah, exactly. It's probably well-intentioned as well from where you're coming from. It's like, yeah, hey, there's this ideal routine. You should really be going to bed at 10, and like, you're not a good person if you don't, or something.
Yeah, well, you're hearing that second part. You're not a good person.
Sure, yeah.
Right? And so it's also finding avenues to have that voice. And part of what we need to do in this community, but wherever you're listening to, is to not just find those avenues to communicate, to have that voice, but if there isn't one, to create one. Mm. And part of what we're talking about today is how we can develop that as a community outlet.
I'd also say that if you find yourself in a place of privilege or authority, that you have the opportunity to create that space where that someone's voice can be heard. And that the I think the defining quality of that space is safe space, mm-hmm. in which you are bringing a non-judgmental, open mind to actually hear what people have as an alternative experience to what your experience is.
But I come back to a partnership. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the biggest issue I deal with not only partners, but with individual clients, is they start, you know, I talk about the four horsemen of people's own individual apocalypse, you know, judgment, shame, guilt, remorse, and I have a half a dozen other of those. And you know your own words. And then they're saying, no, I'm judging others, but the reality is I'm judging myself. I'm fear of judging. And I've got to let go of that. And so getting past that. And so if I'm with my partner, you're projecting all that judgment on them, that they're judging you and you're judging them, and it's never good enough because something's missing within you and you're projecting it out, or some other way of describing. How else would you? Because it's the same condition that we find with an individual, with a family, and with a community. It's the exact same issue in a lot of regards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what comes to mind is when some of this, like suicide that happened recently, when I was thinking, okay, like what can I actually take responsibility for as a community member? To me, it's two things. One is kind of the logistics in terms of the support of like the resources that exist. Are there enough resources? Is there enough awareness of what those resources are? And the access to those resources by the different demographics. And the other side is, do we have a culture or a social environment that is supportive of people seeking health, so we're not stigmatizing it, that they can talk openly about it, and also that we're not creating an environment that's actually toxic or creating additional pressure or like the stigma or the shaming,
yeah,
or
absolutely.
The judging. Because I think shaming, like you're saying, in a partnership, I don't think all shame is just a creation of some projection. I think that I have instances many times in my life in which people are intentionally trying to shame me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
you don't have to accept that.
Sure, yeah, yeah. No, and I don't.
But that's the problem, is if you're strong, if you're feeling good within yourself, great. Oh, okay, that's your judgment. Your stuff's yours, mine's mine. But
if you're vulnerable to mental health concerns, then this is the people. So the people who are most vulnerable are going to have the most issues with any type of kind of social environment that has these types of aspects to them.
I think we got to be careful when we talk mental health issues, because every single one of us on the planet has mental health issues.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, we've all broken up with somebody. We've all felt sad. We've all been depressed. We've all had instances where we're not as strong as we'd like to be. Right?
I agree. Yeah.
It's a human nature itself.
So what do you mean we ought to be careful about talking about mental health? I mean, you said that and then outlined being a human being as having mental health problems.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's
just setting the context. Yeah, I'm in agreement. That's when I say mental health issues, that's what I'm describing is the instances of kind of...
Yeah, mental health is not a negative thing.
No, not at all. Yeah, thank you for clarifying. Yeah. No, but that's what I'm saying. We all have that. And so all of us have found that when we're vulnerable, that we start taking it in, and we take it in from our partners and our family and our society and our communities, but we also take it in by looking in the mirror and like, oh, I'm not good enough.
Yeah. So I think going back to this point of, I think there's a balance of taking responsibility for your own individual health and in every dimension, but then also inventorying how you might be creating, like your influences are affecting others around you in the form of your behavior and your language and the kind of and the energy that you emote.
And also before we started taping, you said, walking down the street, seeing a plant that needed to be watered and stop and water the plant, that we also have some responsibility to be doing some proactive things on our own land in society.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this word responsibility, but definitely if you have the interest and the resources in terms of, and by resources, not necessarily training, although that might be helpful, but in this instance, a lot of times is just space in your life, where if hearing, lending your ear to someone and just listening, if that's something that you can do without becoming overwhelmed by maybe the difficulties that person starts to kind of relieve onto. Then yeah, offer it. I mean, that was more of my attitude is that I do have those resources. I have that capacity. So in the same way that if I see a plant in distress, that I'm just tuned into my environment. And if I see people in distress, that I ask them if there's anything I can do.
Okay. You see the homeless person doesn't mean you ignore them, but you don't have to take them home with you. You care. You don't have to get trapped in other people's stuff. But you are listening to
KRUU. FM 10 What are we pointing at?
I'm pointing at everybody to say,
all right.
This is Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry and quite a crew today with Rob, Doug, and Andrew. Wow, we're having a party here.
Hey, we've been skirting around it and everything, but let's, we talked about having, talking about disempowering paradigms, and we've been talking about those kind of. But let's get down to that, talking about those specifically. And Andrew, start us off.
This is such an extensive topic for
I know.
Me. Yeah, I really don't know where to start, other than that I'm starting to see how prolific and ubiquitous disempowering strategies or disempowering realities are. And I'm trying to think of just one example. I can't actually.
What do you mean by disempowering?
Sometimes when you think about things so much, it's hard to summarize them in a shorter amount. But what I would say, what disempowering is. So,
not necessarily Kuhn's notion, but a little bit more of a socialized.
Sure, yeah. So I'll define both paradigm and disempowering.
You're good.
So I think empowerment essentially is just freedom for me. It's just like, no, like at the base level, I have the truth that I can do whatever I want in this moment. I know that there's going to be consequences to that, but I don't have a story as to why I can't do something. So this is essentially where the disempowering thing comes from. And it's not that I'm a bad person or it's my fault or it's your fault if you're disempowered. It's just that you happen to authentically believe in a narrative that says that you can't do something, whether that's someone offended you and you don't have the right to tell them that, or you don't think a certain policy is fair, but you can't say that for such and such reason. But all those reasons and stories are basically stories that disempower you in that moment from showing up more fully, more honestly and authentically. And so it can restrict your experience of freedom in life, essentially.
And this really does have impact on mental health issues.
Yeah, so describe that to me.
Well, if I feel disempowered, if I'm accepting this paradigm, this belief system of who I am, that I'm not, let's say, good enough. I look in the mirror and I'm not handsome enough, I'm not wealthy enough, I'm not whatever, don't have. And then there's always this lacking and wanting more and more and more. And then it's the old adage, well, I made $1 million, now I need $2 million. Now I made $2 million, now I need $10 million. It's never enough. I've got a beautiful partner, but the partner is not good enough because there's something.
Yeah, or would even think if you're in a relationship, or like, oh, I can't leave this relationship because this reason or something.
Yeah.
But that is also a
That's right.
Situation of disempowerment.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
And it certainly is the case all the time that we see that, right? That people, I can't leave somebody because I'd have to change. I'd have to change my lifestyle. You know.
So kind of where I've done a lot of this thinking is that I just see a lot of the institutions, including our education system, as pretty much encouraging people, if not forcing people, to adopt strategies of disempowerment. That if you went to school knowing exactly what you wanted to do, but you have to sit in behind a desk in front of, or with a teacher in front of you that you may not like, talking about some subject you may not like, that probably is an extremely painful experience if you really were connected with what you wanted to do instead. But instead, we have, through a system of coercion, someone is sitting there. And so they basically have to like internalize that somehow. How do you resolve that dissonance? What story do you tell yourself? And I think that a lot of our institutions do basically encourage people to disempower themselves. That you can't actually do something in this situation. You should just surrender.
Well, it's knock out the creativity out of you, as they say. Kids become more and less creative as they go along.
Mm. Yeah, and now as the system fails too, then we look to like, oh, you know, what's wrong with these kids? We should start, you know, medicating them or treating them in some special way or figuring out different classroom management and kind of ways to punish them or reward them.
It's about control.
It is control.
And so when we start talking about the community aspects, which again, we're saying there's a direct analogy from community to individual to family to whatever, it's the same reality that we're struggling with over and over again. And in an educational system, how do we actually create an educational system that is really looking towards the future, not how it was in the past? Classrooms, for instance, are still designed as they were years ago. Teachers are still teaching in the same basic manner.
Yeah.
And it's more about control than it is about...
And compliance, yeah.
Yeah.
And I would say that if we're not painting a clear enough picture, that these things are deeply connected, intrinsically connected to mental health, I think. That control and compliance and disempowerment and shaming and coercion... I think have long-lasting effects. And if you're sitting there in a classroom not wanting to be there and you're enduring that, and a lot of the adults I talk to now in terms of this paradigm. Yeah, go ahead.
Doug, why don't you chime on in?
I'm wondering about the, you know, relative range of groups and the utility of being involved in groups, which and where groups have cultures and they do have systems for acculturating people to be part of the group. And socially we join groups out of utility also, you know, both individually and then for what groups can do for the individual. And certainly there are good teachers, there are good schools, mm-hmm. relatively, and so in the spectrum of things, so it's not. Yes, there's disempowerment, but...
So we got to talk about expansion. We're just about out of time. Great, great thought. This is a lively discussion that we can all chime on in. Believe me, we could have lots of talks. Let's just go around one more time. Andrew?
Yeah, just like to wrap up the idea with the schools. I think that the fundamental principle I would put forward is just the simple concept of consent. That when people don't have a consensual experience, when you force an experience onto someone that's not consensual, that it's traumatic.
Okay. And so learning how to create that consensual dialogue within a school, but also in a partnership and within yourself.
Yeah, and it requires inquiring into that
person's inquiry,
experience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't have anything to say.
And this is Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. It was so great of everybody to stop in, and please come on back.
Doug Hamilton and Andrew, thank you very, very much for coming by.
Cheers.
Bye.